702. The Naked Scientist.
24 minutes to 3 o'clock, time for The Naked Scientist. Send all your science-related questions through to us. Give us a call, 011-883-0702, and the WhatsApp line, 072-702-1702. Dr. Chris Smith, happy Monday. How are you doing?
Happy Monday. I'm very good. How are you?
I am fantastic. It is actually quite chilly in Joburg today, and it's making me very worried that the winter is going to be ridiculously cold. Please advise if this whole, you know, climate change issue means that our winters are getting worse, because I'm not built for the cold.
Yeah, well, it's not that warm here either, if that makes you feel any better. But the bottom line is, with climate change, it's not that we all suddenly get warmer. What we're expecting to see is more extremes of weather, because there's more energy in the atmosphere. So rainstorms, more extreme and more frequent. Thunderstorms, more extreme, more frequent. Wind and other kinds of extremes, more common. The reason being, when you've got more energy in the atmosphere, the process that's driving all of the weather is driven by that energy. So the more of it there is, the more weather events we're going to see. And then there are other more subtle phenomena, where if you have, say, a current of warm water like we do here in the UK, the Gulf Stream, which comes from the Gulf of Mexico up the west coast of the UK, this is being, we think, slowed down and diverted by melting Arctic waters, because as the water melts, that cold water and fresh water tipping into the ocean is pushing back the Gulf Stream. Well, that heat, which is brought to the west of the UK and keeps us at a very artificially elevated high temperature, that will switch off that conveyor. So the result of that will be we have less heat delivery to our patch of the Earth, and therefore we revert more to the sorts of climate we would expect based on our latitude. And London is roughly about as far up the planet as Moscow. And in winter, Moscow's minus 20, London's about 5. Mm. If we go into a full-blown cessation of the Gulf Stream because of this, we would expect us, paradoxically, in the context of climate change, to get colder. So there will be those sorts of knock-on consequences as well. So certainly weather extremes will become more extreme. Some places get wetter, some places get drier, some will get hotter, some will get colder. But the difference between all those things is what's likely to become more exaggerated under climate change. And that's true everywhere on Earth.
All right, we open the lines, 011-883-0702, and the WhatsApp line, 072-702-1702.
Hi, my name is Zoe, and this is a question for the Naked Scientist. I would just want to ask, why do bees die after they lose their stinger?
Thank you so much for that question.
Yes, unlike wasps, which can sting almost as many times as they want to, and sometimes that's a lot, bees can only sting once, and then, as is being pointed out, they perish. The reason is, if you look at the sting of a wasp and compare it with the sting of a bee under a microscope, they are very different shapes. Wasp stings are sharp, pointy, and smooth on the outside. A bee sting, on the other hand, looks like a harpoon. It has hooks down the outside. And the point of that is that when the bee deploys its sting, it lodges in you, and then as the bee flies away, it rips the back end of the bee out, including the stinging apparatus and the venom, and this continues to inject you with venom. And the purpose of those harpoons is that it can't easily be dislodged, and this means it's more likely to sting you and make you notice. What do wasps do? Well, they use a different combination of venom, and they have a way of propelling that down their sting and into you without it leaving the sting behind, because it's smooth. It goes in, deploys some poison, and then comes out again. So this is why bees die, because they've flown away and left half their back end in you to sting you after the bee's gone away.
Thank you so much for that question that came through. Here is an interesting one, and it might have come from possibly from the conversation we had earlier, Doctor. We were chatting about anger and how what we do with that anger, with a recent study showing that instead of doing things like running or venting to a friend, which is not the way to go, the study was saying that the way to go is actually to do the meditation thing and the calming yourself down that way. But the question from Kenneth is, some people have said when they are angry, they pray. The question from Kenneth is, can the doctor be able to explain the science of a prayer?
Well, what are we doing when we're praying? What we're doing is A, appealing to a higher power that we hope will help us. And we all seem to be programmed to have this susceptibility as a population, a global population, because if you look at history and archaeology, over time, we have all, despite being different parts of the world, very different cultures and so on, tended to center around a belief in higher power. So our brains to give us the capacity to A, summon up the ideas and thoughts, and B, to exploit them. So therefore we have some kind of innate desire to talk to God, whatever God is for us and our creed and culture. And why this might be helpful to us is that when we are having those inner conversations, hearing ourselves putting things and thoughts and feelings into words to a third party can sometimes be incredibly powerful, because it forces you to crystallize into words what your thoughts and feelings are. Then you voice them, even if it's in your inner voice rather than externally, and you're listening to that voice, whether it's coming in through your ears or through your inner voice. And therefore, you are encoding the thoughts and feelings into a message, and then you're decoding it. So you're almost like hearing it from a third party, back to hearing yourself saying these things. And this can give us very strong perspectives on things. It can help us to think, well, actually, that doesn't sound very reasonable, or actually, that doesn't sound very good for me. I do think I've been hard done by. So it can be a good way to develop an argument or develop feelings or help feelings work through, so you can come to a sort of conclusion about the best way to manage a situation. And if you're revising for an exam, doing the same sort of thing can be incredibly powerful, because you hear yourself making the points that you would make in your essay or whatever, and it helps to crystallize the meaning, the relationships between the different things you're trying to invoke or argue. And also it helps you to hear what the words sound like. And often you as a radio presenter will know, Lebo, that often people, if they're going to present a piece on the radio, they will voice it out first. They'll sit down to an empty studio, turn the microphone on, and listen to themselves almost performing that thing.
Yeah.
And it's the same sort of thing. You hear yourself, and hearing the words come out of your mouth, you actually get to test how they're going to be developing, how they're going to sound, what sort of emphasis you can put on them in the right sort of way. So I think it's part and parcel of all of those things. And so sitting down and praying to somebody, whether that person is a god or just someone you're thinking about in your mind, I think it helps us to crystallize our thoughts in a slightly different way, and gather our thoughts and present them in a logical way, or more logical way. And also, you let off some steam, because the number one thing about getting angry is let off steam. And if you go on an anger management course or one of these how to handle difficult staff member courses that you get sent on when you go into management, one of the things they'll say is, as soon as there's some conflict, back off, walk away, cool off, then come back and have a rational conversation about it. And I think all these things are part and parcel of that.
So I'm wondering, would the same effect be there for people who talk to themselves? Because I always wondered why they needed to say things out loud. But I think sometimes it helps them think better and have that clarity you're speaking about.
Yeah. And when I'm doing certain things, if it's complicated stuff, and I'm trying to solve a problem, and I've got the thing in front of me, I might start talking to myself saying, well, if I do that, then that will probably happen, and then that. And it's almost like you've got another person in the room to kind of bounce ideas off of. And I think part of the reason is that hearing it coming in through your ears and then into the receptive areas of your brain, in some people, I suspect the bandwidth, as in the number of connections in the brain, is perhaps enhanced via the information coming in through that route than just trying to short circuit that internally and hearing your own inner voice saying these things. I think there's an additional layer of filtering that goes on if you hear yourself saying those things, because it can help you to process the information slightly differently. And so you're not mad if you talk to yourself. Everyone does it all the time. The embarrassing thing is if you get caught doing it when you turn around and there's someone behind you and then they go, oh, hi, Chris. And you say, hello, just talking to myself.
I love that. Absolutely love that. All right, more questions are coming through. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, a question around sore muscles.
The Naked Scientist.
We're with the Naked Scientist. Give us a call, 011-883-0702, and the WhatsApp line, 072-702-1702. Let's go to the lines. We've got Anthony from Soweto. Anthony, how's it?
I'm okay. Can I speak to the doctor?
Yes, go ahead.
The question I'm asking is, when material is frozen, it actually contracts, but water expands. For example, if you have water in the bottle and you put it in the freezer, it expands. Why is that? What is the chemistry there?
Right, okay. Well, it certainly does happen, doesn't it? We know that when you take a volume of water and you freeze it, the volume increases, it expands, and it makes it less dense. That's why ice floats. The reason for this is all to do with how the water molecules organize themselves in three-dimensional space. In a liquid, the water molecules are quite close together, and they stick together because one part of the molecule is a bit positive and the other part of another adjacent molecule is a bit negative. They stick together. That's called hydrogen bonding. And it turns out that the way the water molecules organize themselves as a liquid is in a configuration which is the most energetically favorable. In other words, the particles jockey for position until they're in the most energetically organized, lowest energy state they can be. And because of a quirk of the chemistry and the physics of the way that these water molecules look and the shape and the distribution of charges, when they freeze, the way they organize themselves into the most stable, lowest energy, most balanced organization is with more space between them than in the liquid. And this makes water very unusual because in most circumstances, liquids are take up more space than solids. So it goes solids are the most dense and the smallest, liquids a bit bigger, gases bigger still. In water, the gas is obviously very big and the liquid is smaller, but the solid bucks the trend, and the organization of the water molecules means there is more space between them, so it makes the solid ice bigger.
Thank you so much for that question. Was one on the WhatsApp line that came through from Heidi, and Heidi says, what is the quickest way to deal with sore muscles after exercise?
Hi Heidi, it depends whether we're talking about acutely the sore muscles right now, you've just done some exercise, or in the longer term. Obviously, as you train more, things improve, because the reason muscles get sore when we exercise is because when you use a muscle, you do actually do a little bit of damage. Inside a muscle are contractile elements, they're called inner myosin, the muscle filament, and they hold of each other. One winches itself along the other one, the muscle contract. And the more you use a muscle, the more force through a muscle, the more you wear out elements and tear them and break them down. And the muscle then has some damage. It secretes various inflammatory factors that make it swell and cause inflammation. That causes pain, and it also provokes the muscle to repair itself. So when this is acutely happening and you're thinking, I've just pulled the muscle, or I've just tripped over and really hurt something during a running race or something, putting ice on it at that point is really, really beneficial. So the first thing you should do, cool the area. And this is because if you want to stop the pain acutely, putting cold something cold onto the bruised or damaged area will help, because it slows down the chemical reactions that cause inflammation. And if you have fewer inflammatory factors there, you'll have less inflammation and therefore less pain. If it's because of work usage and you've run a marathon or something and the next day your legs are quite sore, this is, again, it's the process of inflammation and damage and repair going on. Just making sure you don't overdo it. Give your muscles a chance to recover each time with gentle stretches and that kind of thing. This will help them to slowly regain, but also making sure you eat well and rest afterwards, because then the muscles can repair themselves. And if it's really sore, some anti-inflammatories for a short while, like ibuprofen if you can take that, or aspirin if you can take that, paracetamol. That's really good, as long as no allergies, of course, in the short term, just to take the edge off it. But letting the muscles recover after a bout of intense exercise is what's really important.
Thank you so much, Heidi, for that question. Trilani from Centurion, go ahead.
Hi. So I wanted to know that, other than through a fusion or an operation, is there a way of medical technology of dealing with pinched nerves?
Right, okay. I suspect you're talking, are you, about, say, sciatica, or if you have a bad back and you pinch off a nerve and you feel pins and needles down your back, or you have a neck problem and you get numb fingers in your arm, for example. The answer is it would depend on what the cause of this is. If it's in your lower back and you bend over and feel something go, then your leg gets numb, or you get needles or weakness in your leg. I get that look. But very often this is of a disc problem, because each of the bone back are spongy discs, which are like shock absorbers, but the material they're made of has a hard outer surface and a soft inside. And when they're subject to big stresses, and also with age, they tend to weaken, the outer tough layer can break down enough to allow a bulge of the softer stuff from inside to pop out. And where the nerves leave the spinal cord, they go through quite a tight sort of gap or hole in the bone, and there's not much space for the nerves and blood vessels to go through there. And if you have a herniation, as it's called, of one of the discs into that space, it can press or squeeze the nerve as it goes through that gap, and this is very, very painful. And normally it gets better on its own, and you just need to do things gently, take things easy for a while, take some painkillers and so on, it will recover. Sometimes surgery is necessary to help to relieve the pressure. But there are other places in the body where if nerves get pinched, the symptoms are the same. If you squeeze a nerve, it doesn't work properly, and the territory it supplies can become weakened, and also you get funny sensations from that area. It will all come down to what is causing the problem anatomically. And sometimes surgery is the only option, and you have to go in, relieve the pressure, and then stabilize the thing which has either broken or shifted or moved, causing the pinching phenomenon. So it will come down to what is the cause of the pathology that's caused the problem in the first place. And then the best treatment will be a medical one. Do nothing apart from let the person have gentle exercise, physiotherapy, painkillers, or a surgical intervention where you go in and actually operate and move things round to stabilize things and stop a recurrence. And it will very much depend on how old the person is, what the mechanism of their problem is, and therefore what the best outcome is likely to be for them, because it's different problems require different interventions and have different levels of success.
Thank you so much for that question that's come through. When we look at the WhatsApp line, 0727021702, this is an interesting one. If it were possible and someone had to give birth on another planet, would the child be considered an alien? Love this question.
Yes, you'd be a Martian, wouldn't you? Because if you are born in South Africa, you're South African. If you're born in Britain, you're British. If you're born on Earth, you're a human Earthling. If you're born on Mars, well, you're born on Mars. Therefore, using that same extension of those sort of jurisdictions and boundaries, you would be a Martian.
I absolutely love that question. Thank you so much for sending it through. Another one that's come through. We've noticed bees in our house roof, and by the looks of things, the gang is getting bigger. I would like to ask if it's true that they are a symbol of luck or ancestors, and how do I protect my family for potential bee stings? Thank you very much.
Well, bees normally, the one thing about bees is they're normally no trouble. They normally behave themselves, because the queen bee secretes various pheromones that keep the worker bees, who are all female, under wraps, under control, and cooperating and behaving. And those worker bees are all working to help the queen stay healthy so she can lay more bees to make an even bigger colony. Bees tend to become more aggressive as the queen ages. And the queen can live for years, does live for years. But as she ages, her supply of these various pheromones that keep the colony in check do weaken. And so if you start to get bees misbehaving, it could be because they've got a weak queen. Also, some populations of bees just naturally have behavioural problems, a bit like humans, I suppose.
And my brother, I was about to say.
Well, my brother keeps bees, and he's got about 30 hives, and some of them are terrific, and they're no problem at all. Others, you just have to go in line with the opening to the hive so that you're in the flight path, and they just immediately go for you. And they're just, he uses rude words to describe those bees. I won't repeat them on the radio, but those ones is a combination of old queens, but also some are just innately not very nice. So if your bees are nice and they're not causing you a problem, they're doing the world a great service. And bees are having a hard time at the moment. They're having a hard time with various things, trying desperately to wipe them out. So welcome your bees and look upon them as a symbol of luck. If they do start to get aggressive, or you do have people in the house who are allergic to stings and things, then A, take steps to make sure you've got antihistamines and other things to ward off problems if there are stings. But you can get people to come remove them, and beekeepers are really very good at coming along with a box, and they know how to knock the colony into the box, and they'll take it away, and then they put them into a hive, and then the bees start a new home in a hive somewhere that isn't inconvenient for you. So that's the option, is A, leave them alone if they're leaving you alone. If they are problematical, call up your local beekeepers association and someone will come around and they would be delighted to relieve you of your nice big colony of bees.
Good advice there. Whenever in doubt, the SPCA, call them and they will have an idea of where you can go. Thank you so much, Dr. Chris Smith.
You're welcome.